Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 98 for Thursday, April 7th, 2011. Gottlieb Daimler lied! Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks for joining us again, folks, here at Autoline After Hours. And with me, as always, is my partner in crime, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, good evening.
It's good, all right.
How are you?
I'm doing great, actually. Yeah. I feel pretty good.
That's good.
I know. It's really good. Because
we've got 60s and 70s coming here, which is, for people outside of this region, just don't realize what a revelation that is.
Snow-soaked region, right? Yeah, it's like...
With their crumbling roads.
Oh, man. They're only going to get worse.
I know.
Wait till the thaw really hits, man. It's going to be like driving in mush out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also joining us tonight is Bob Casey, the transportation curator at the Henry Ford Museum. Great having you here, too, Bob.
I'm delighted to be here.
And we got a lot to talk to you later in the show, but some of the things I wanted to get some of Peter's feedback on what he's thinking is, what is going on with Saab? I mean, they closed down their assembly lines. They assured everybody, oh, it's no big deal. It was just a hiccup. And now they're completely shut down because they're not paying their suppliers.
Yeah, millions upon millions. And that figure isn't public yet. But the suppliers don't get paid. It could be the final Saab story.
You know? It could be, although...
We both like the new 9.5.
Looks great.
And
the 9.4X, yeah. At least in pictures, looks good. I haven't seen it,
which is
drive it.
The SRX Cadillac underneath, right?
Exactly.
Still.
Right.
But yeah, I want them to survive. But when you owe, millions upon millions to suppliers, I don't know.
Well, what the analysts are saying is all he needs is like a couple of big sugar daddies to step forward, dump a bunch of money into the company, get stock in return. There's this Russian billionaire, Vladimir Antonov, who's willing to buy, just shy of a third of the company. But
why, though?
Yeah, why is a good question.
It's an ego purchase, right?
Probably. For him, a couple of $100 million is probably nothing.
Yeah.
It's like us buying a pack of gum. But, the real problem is their sales are nowhere near where they need to be in the U.S. market. And we should talk about March sales because there's some interesting stuff in there. Sales for Saab in the U.S. market last month were up 500%, which is real impressive.
But from nothing.
From nothing, right. I think they'd sold 800 cars. And, by my figuring, they got to be doing about like 2,500 cars just to, pretend like they're in the game right now.
A month.
A month. Yeah. I'm talking a month. Exactly. They need to get to like 30,000 units as fast as they can just in the American market. Victor Muller, who runs the company, is saying they ought to be able to get to 80,000 globally this year. But
oh boy.
You're not making cars. You're not going to sell that kind of number.
No.
And speaking of March sales, though, it was a pretty strong month.
Yeah, it was surprisingly strong. But as some of the analysts and some of the manufacturers pointed out, there was a notable weakening of light truck sales, because of the gas prices and slight.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that argument. What I'll point out is that, no question, passenger cars, especially in the smaller end, were red hot. That's what sold. Passenger cars went to 51, 52% of the market. And it's been a while since they were ahead of trucks. But truck sales were up.
Well, trucks,
it's just that they weren't up as much as cars were.
Yeah.
So they lost market share, but it's not like sales were down.
Yeah, so but there will be a gap, you know. I think there will be a softening. I think we're going to see $5 a gallon for premium in the U.S.
this summer.
I don't know if we're going to be wait that long. Yeah, sure. And the West Coast and Hawaii, you know, they've probably seen that. They saw it in 08, but... you know, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, what are the consumers really going to do this go around? 08, they freaked. And they just stopped.
Well, they stopped buying.
They stopped buying, and they especially stopped buying trucks, which, you know, with everything else going on with the economy at that time, the global economy, that basically was it for Detroit,
mm-hmm.
for two of the three manufacturers. They just, they couldn't recover. And then, you know, the bankruptcies. You know, this go around is different. But it'll be interesting because all of the people coming off their leases are going to buy in market in the next 90 days. It's going to be very interesting.
You know, I wonder if Ford's got a leg up in the truck segment because it's got EcoBoost in the F-150 now.
Not only do they have EcoBoost, but I don't know if anyone realizes that they're going to offer a four-cylinder in the Explorer.
I know. Yeah.
And
EcoBoost 4 cylinder.
EcoBoost 4. And, you know, people say, oh, I don't want that. Really, for around town, it's fine.
Yeah. If you don't tow, if you don't haul big loads in your Explorer, right.
And the Explorer is still red hot. And, you know, that I don't think that motor comes online till midsummer, but still. You know, when they announced that, everyone was scoffed at it, but it's like...
I'm not scoffing at all because I drove it in the Ford Flex, and I was blown away at how well it worked. I would have never guessed that a 2-liter four, the Flex is not exactly a lightweight or welterweight kind of.
No, and it's the same weight as the Explorer. So
is it really?
Yeah.
Well, then there you go. I can tell you from driving a 2-liter EcoBoost in the Flex, it works just fine.
I think, yeah, you mentioned Ford has a leg up. I absolutely think they have a leg up.
So, you know, going back to the truck things, Ford sold 53,000 F-Series last month. So, yeah, you know, pass cars were red hot, small cars, hybrids, too, did extremely well. Or I shouldn't say that. Three hybrids did extremely well. You know, two Toyotas and a Honda. The rest of them, forget about it.
Yeah.
And so 53,000 F-Series with gasoline nudging up against $4 a gallon in many places in the country, that's not too shabby.
And that EcoBoost engine in the F-Series is sweet. I mean, it runs great.
Yeah, it does. And that's the other thing we got to talk about here is Ford went ahead of General Motors in sales. And this is after killing off Mercury. So Mercury didn't help them. And Lincoln sales actually declined year over year. So Lincoln didn't help it at all.
So this is the second time in?
Second time in about a decade for 1 month
right. That
Ford went ahead of General Motors.
Yeah, it's just 1 month. But, you know, there's definitely a seismic shift going on in acceptance in the market, I believe.
Can they keep it going?
Well, they've got the products. I mean, the Focus isn't even online yet, and I think they're a little concerned about the slow rollout of it. And but once that comes online, I think that's going to become the mainstream American car.
The Focus.
It's that good, yeah.
I don't think they have enough production capacity to outsell Accord and Camry.
Well, no, but eventually, I do believe people will look at that as the mainstream American car. That C segment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Will be the mainstream. And when you're looking at it, you've got, well, what do you have? You have Focus and Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
As far as mainstream American C cars. So.
Right. Yeah, Chrysler's not really in the ball game there.
No.
Not with what they got right now. Hey, last night I went out to jumping topics completely here. I went to see the opening of Tech Shop in Detroit. This is...
it's an unbelievable concept.
It's so cool. It started in California. This one guy, Jim Newton is his name, came up with an idea of getting like a big industrial building, filling it chock full of manufacturing equipment, laser welders, laser cutters, milling machines, lathes, rapid prototyping, painting. If you want to make anything, you can make it at this place. So then you join it like a health club. It costs you like $100 a month. So you pay your monthly fee, and you get to use all this equipment. You can go in and make whatever you want. So they started it in Silicon Valley. Then they went to, they just opened one, I think, a month ago in San Francisco. They're coming to Detroit. They had their, like, grand opening. Well, not grand opening, because it's really not going to open until July. But they're doing it here, and it was Ford that brought them here. Ford gave them this. It's a beautiful building. God, it's really impressive. Must be a couple hundred thousand square feet. It's big. And Ford, there's a guy at Ford named Bill Coughlin, who I really don't know a whole lot about, but I know he's in charge of all the intellectual property that Ford has, and it licenses that technology to anybody who wants to use it, mostly other automakers or companies in the auto industry. So they get all these royalties. I'd love to know what the number is. All Bill Coughlin would say is it's not exactly chump change. So he says he's got to give most of the money to the mothership, but Ford lets his department reinvest a given amount of that money to hopefully grow Ford's intellectual property. And he says since they started doing that, he has brought in more revenue. So what his idea is, he brings tech shop to Detroit, gives them this building to use that Ford had sitting empty there, and he said that in their R&D operations, they always have people that want to work on new ideas, build prototypes, and Ford just can't always accommodate it. You know, they've got stuff they're working on, and maybe these guys can't get to the equipment they want. So Bill Coughlin's idea is, hey, somebody has a good idea, wants to build a prototype, I'll buy them 3 to 4 months of memberships at Tech Shop. Just tell them to go make it there. He wants a what he's calling a YouTube studio, so people can come in and learn how to do videos and learn how to post it to YouTube. He wants a retail store, so if you make stuff there, you can sell it in the retail store. And so while it's ostensibly this tech shop deal, Ford Research is going to be playing a huge role in this. And as you guys know, most vocational training has been eliminated from high schools, especially shop. Yeah. And there's still a few schools that have got them. So what they want to do is partner with high schools in the area and say, hey, send your kids here. We're going to have equipment like no high school could ever afford to have and teach these kids, you know, good skilled trades kind of stuff that they can take and get good jobs with.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I'm really impressed by this idea. I can see it really working. Then one other news thing that I thought was very interesting this week, Toyota dodged a big bullet. You know, the first lawsuit against this so-called sudden unintended acceleration. I say so-called because, you know, we know that, yes, there are floor mats that get trapped under the pedal. Yes, we know there were some accelerator pedals that were sticky. And then there's driver error, which I believe it is, where people mistakenly, hey, we're human, we make mistakes. People press on the gas pedal instead of the brake, and they get in accidents, and they sue Toyota and say, oh, there's mysterious problems in here. And the first case that went to trial, Toyota won. And I think that's huge. I think it's not just a victory for the for Toyota. It's a victory for the auto industry.
No, absolutely. But there will always be ambulance-chasing lawyers who will keep it going as long as they possibly can. But, yeah, that was a significant win for them.
Right. And, you know, to your point, Peter, look, there's going to be many, many, many more lawsuits. And it's not likely that Toyota's going to win them all. But it's good to see that it starts out with juries recognizing that there isn't just some mysterious problem that causes cars to accelerate out of control. And I know I've gotten some hate mail about that. But, you know, as I keep pointing out, this is not a new problem. It existed before there were any electronics in cars.
And guess
it affects
what?
Every manufacturer.
And guess what? There hasn't been one reported incident with a manual transmission.
And that's the real telling one.
Not one.
Not one. And what do we read into that? People who drive manuals tend to be better drivers.
Yes.
It takes a certain amount of skill.
And speaking of better drivers, John, don't we have a new returning sponsor to talk about tonight?
Well, we do.
Not yet.
Well, we've got Hyundai is coming back to sponsor the show, and it's great to have them. In fact, everybody go to our website and click on the Hyundai logo just to show them that you're appreciative of their support of what we're doing here. In fact, why don't we take a quick little break here for one of our other sponsors, and then we'll get Bob Casey in with us. But I want to take a moment to talk about the Chevrolet Cruze, which you can check out at chevrolet.com/cruze. You can get a 6-speed manual in this thing, which I just had a week ago in the Eco version, or 6-speed automatic. Pioneer Premium 9-speaker sound system. More passenger or cargo room than the Civic, Corolla, or Focus. And with the manual, it gets better fuel economy than they do. And you can check it all out at chevrolet.com/cruze, and that's spelled C-R-U-Z-E. And now let's turn to our other guest here, or our guest in the studio. Our other guest is the dog sleeping on the floor.
Yes, right.
But Bob Casey, that's really cool. You got the job of transportation curator. Do I have that right? Did I say that all correctly?
Curator of transportation, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which means I have the things that roll on the road or fly through the air. The things that run on rails are actually the province of another curator.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Okay. So you don't have the trains.
I don't have the trains or the trolleys or anything like that.
See, people who have never been in a museum, that's one of the most unbelievable things is to see those massive trains.
Monster-sized locomotives. Monster-sized. I mean, it's they've got to be the biggest locomotives that were made in the world.
The locomotive that we have, which is called the Allegheny, that was the class of it, is supposedly the heaviest ever made. The big boys that Union Pacific used to run out west were longer, but ours is heavier. So take your pick as to what your definition of big is.
Still impressive.
It's extraordinarily impressive, yeah.
But you get to ride herd over all the fun stuff, too, right?
Well, I think they're fun stuff, yeah. It's the cars and the bicycles and the horse-drawn stuff and the motorcycles and the airplanes.
So talk a little bit about your cars. You know, what all is in the collection? Not every single one, but, you know, from what year and what kinds?
Actually, our car collection runs from 1865.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Stop right there.
I knew that would be good.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. I'll catch you, yes.
What is Gottlieb Daimler going to have to say about that?
I think his car wasn't a gleam in his eye. In 1865, there was a gentleman in Massachusetts named Sylvester Roper who got interested in applying steam technology to carriages. And he built a series of horseless carriages run by steam, burning charcoal. He also built a steam-powered motorcycle.
Wow. When was the motorcycle?
This was also in the 1860s.
So the Civil War is going on, and this guy's making cars.
Cars. And we have one of them.
Why does he never get credit? Why do the Germans always say, well, we did it in 1899?
Well, the interesting thing is that at the time he was building these things, and he built like half a dozen. He wasn't turning them out. And they were all sort of one-offs. But he would demonstrate them at fairs and circuses and things, or people would go to the county fair and he'd drive the thing around the horse track. People would pay and they'd applaud. There was nobody was writing him letters saying, build me one of those. When are you going to put them into production? There was no public demand for these things.
They were scared of them, or they didn't see any value?
They saw them as novelties. You have to remember, people had figured out how to get around. They had horses. They had trains. They had carriages. They had a variety of ways to get around, and nobody saw a pressing need for something that was motorized. Ratchet forward 40 years or so, and 30 years, actually, when people like Henry Ford and others, the Germans, the Daimlers and all, are messing around with horseless carriages. And there actually is a public interest. A lot of historians, and I'm one of them, think that part of what happened was really two things. One was bicycles, which gave people the idea that you could get a personal vehicle that you could get on whenever you wanted and go wherever you wanted, regardless of the schedule, and go faster than you could walk and faster than horses normally went, because horses mostly walked, and horses don't walk any faster than we do. The other thing was the really cheap buggy, so that you could order a buggy from Sears Roebuck for $25, and it would show up at the depot, and you could go in and take your horse in if you were a farmer. And for the first time, you could have a vehicle whose only purpose was hauling people. You could afford one. You didn't have to use your farm wagon. And I think that began to whet people's appetite for personal transportation that allowed you to go wherever you wanted, when you wanted. When the automobile comes along, or the horseless carriage, as it was called, people began to see it in a different way from the way they saw it when Sylvester Roper made his steamer in 1865.
Now, wait, because weren't the British making steam coaches even earlier than that?
The British made steam coaches even earlier, and they were like the equivalent of small buses, like stagecoaches. They would haul several passengers. And the stagecoach operators got together and got the British government to ban them, that they were dangerous and they were scaring horses. And this is where the infamous red flag law came along, that you had to walk along and carry a red flag in front of these things.
Which meant that these vehicles could only go as fast as the guy walking holding a red flag.
So there was all of a sudden there was no advantage to them. The actually small steam engines were quite technologically quite feasible. So that's why our earliest car is from 1865.
That's mind-blowing. I never knew that.
Well, other highlights, you have some fabulous competition cars. You've got the famous Mercedes competition car. You've got Jim Clark's Lotus Ford that won Indy that has just been recently restored.
We've actually in the last few years tried to broaden our racing collection. We've added the Goldenrod, the car that held the land speed record for wheel-driven vehicles. Yeah. Four Chrysler Hemis in a row went 407 miles an hour at Bonneville. If you're a drag racing fan, you remember George Montgomery and his 33 Willys Gasser. We bought that from George.
I saw that run in period.
Did you really?
Yeah.
It's just awesome at night, too.
Even more so.
We've got a the most recent race car that we acquired was another Bonneville car. It was a belly tank Lakester.
Oh, excellent.
It was run by a guy named Tom Beatty, who's one of the first hot rodders to mess around with supercharging. And he started this car out with flathead Fords, and then he moved to Oldsmobiles. And started running at Bonneville in the early 50s, turning in the 180s. And by the time he stopped running this car, about 1963, he was going, I think he went 243.
Huh. Oh, man.
We've got a 56 Chrysler stock car that was run by Carl Kiekhafer, who ran, his real business was Mercury Outboards.
But he was the Roger Penske of the 50s.
Absolutely. Huh. Flat dominated NASCAR.
Yeah, for what, 3 years?
55 and 56.
Yeah.
And we've got one of the 56s. They won 22 out of 41 races.
Wow. That year. That's awesome. That's amazing.
And what is astonishing about that car is how stock it is. It's got the original front seat. It's got the headliner in it. I mean, the dash is standard. They took the back seat out, and it's, you know, it's the suspension is beefed up, and there is a roll bar. Not really a cage, but a roll bar. But in those days, when they said stock car, they were
what they meant.
Pretty stock. Hmm. Yeah.
And you also have historical, the Kennedy limousine from Dallas that was sanitized.
We have four presidential limousines. They were all Lincolns. The reason we have them is that Lincoln didn't sell them to the government. They leased them. And when they came back from lease, the Lincoln gave them to us. And we have the car that Kennedy was riding in 63. You say...
It was cleaned up. You know, not like today when there's a crime investigation where everything is...
left as is.
And they, you know...
Well, what they did is that... I mean, the car was evidence, and it was in the hands of the Warren Commission. Once it was released, the Secret Service sent it out to get it armor plated because it was not an armored car. There was no bulletproof glass. There was no armor. And there was no permanent roof on the car. There were a variety of roofs that you could put on, but they were all removable. And so they literally tore the car apart, armor plated it, put a permanent roof on it, thick. I mean, the bulletproof glass is, you know, 2 inches thick. And then returned it to service. Johnson used it, Nixon used it, Ford used it after the Kennedy assassination. And we also have...
Well, wait. Let's stick with that car a minute, okay. Because the car as it sits in the museum doesn't have that big bubble top on it, does it?
What it has on it is a permanent fixed roof.
Oh, a steel roof.
Yeah, it has a steel roof.
So you haven't... quote unquote, restored the car to the way it was during the assassination.
To return it back to the way it was with the assassination, I mean, it would be just an enormous job. Yeah. You'd literally have to cut the roof off and try to put it back. Yeah. We also have the car that Ronald Reagan was getting into, because we just passed this anniversary.
Yeah, we did.
When he was shot. And we had CNN did a program on that with Jerry Parr, who was the Secret Service man who shoved Reagan into the car
and took a bullet himself.
And
one
of the other guys.
Okay.
I mean, the guy literally stood up to take the bullet, and he did. But for the first time, I really understood how Reagan got shot, and it was a complete fluke. Parr shoved him into the car. The rear door of the car was a suicide door, and the bullet ricocheted off the car between the gap between the door and the car. Reagan had his arms out to catch himself because he was going to get shoved into the back seat. And while his arms are out, the one place that bullet could have gone and got him, it did. And it caught him under the armpit.
Wow.
And he didn't know it really until Parr kind of figured it out. And that's when they went off to the hospital.
Huh. So... what leads you to collect a car then? When do you go, we need that one?
That's an excellent question. We try to have a car collection that is very broadly representative of what is available in the American market over time. So we do have extraordinary vehicles like the presidential cars. We have a Duesenberg. We have some very high-end Lincolns. We also have very cheap cars. We have the kinds of cars that get used up and thrown away. Fords and Chevys and Willys and earlier cars like that. But we're looking for something that is in some way broadly representative of styling trends or engineering trends or marketing trends. or something that is representative of a particular period. And so we have one of the more eclectic collections of museums, where you go some places and you'll think that my God, in the late 20s, everybody drove a Duesenberg. Well, no. Or, you know, we have one muscle car. We don't have a bunch, because we have a Pontiac GTO, a 67 GTO, and that speaks to muscle car-ness, if you will. We're actually in the process of completely revising our car exhibit, and we are actively collecting some additional cars.
Like what? What are you after now?
We just acquired and you're gonna think this is odd, we just acquired a 1998 Dodge Quad Cam pickup truck. Quad cab pickup truck. Now, why, you would say?
Yes, why?
Yeah.
I do say.
one of the trends of the last 20 years, maybe even 30 years, has been the morphing of the pickup truck into an alternative for the family car. And that quad cab Dodge with a suicide rear door, when you open up the, it's got four doors, it's got a full back seat, you open up the front and the rear door, and you have better access to that back seat than you do in any four-door sedan. It is essentially, functionally, it's a sedan with a gigantic trunk.
Yeah.
And so we want to address that trend of the whole morphing of the pickup truck. I mean, the two best-selling vehicles in the country for years have been pickup trucks. Another vehicle that we're looking for and we're almost ready to acquire is an 89 Honda Accord. Now, again, you'd say, why? That is the first year that a Japanese nameplate was the best-selling car in the country. Honda Accords in 89. That's a significant milestone when the American public will make a Japanese nameplate the best-selling passenger car.
Now, didn't you have, or don't you have, the first Accord that Honda built in America?
And that's on loan. Okay. Honda has been very gracious, and we've had it on loan for a long time. But it is, yes, it's the first Accord off the line at Marysville, Ohio.
Because I think I was there when Mr. Honda himself gave it to the museum, or loaned it to the museum.
Yeah, he did. And he was an admirer of Henry Ford's, and he was delighted to have one of his vehicles in our museum. Yeah.
And then you have historical vehicles. For example, the bus that Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat and move to the back end.
Mm-hmm. That was a vehicle that...
It was just recently restored, right?
About, I guess, maybe 4 years ago or so. That bus had, when the bus company in Montgomery sold it, or got was ready to get rid of it, you know, it had finished its useful life, a fellow in Alabama bought it and another bus, and he lived out in the country, and he wanted essentially tool sheds. So he bought these two buses, took the seats out, took the motor and transmission out, sold them, and pretty much paid for the purchase price of the buses that way, and stored tools in these buses. And he'd been told that one of these buses was the bus that Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on. At one point, he actually tried to sell it on eBay, and nobody would believe him. But an auction house got interested in it, did the research, came to the conclusion that this was the bus, and they put it up for auction. We and there were other people who got into this. The Smithsonian was also interested in it. And we checked it out, checked the records all the way back to when it came off the line at GM Truck and Bus in Pontiac. It had been sold at Terre Haute, Indiana, and then they sold it to Montgomery, Alabama. The auction house had found a collection of clippings, newspaper clippings that had been done for the bus company. And the guy who kept the clippings had written on a couple of articles about Rosa Parks being arrested, had written the number of the bus and the name of the driver. And it was still that number. That number, you could trace it all the way back to the Pontiac. That's the number it had on it. And basically, I mean, we hired a forensic document expert to look at the papers. I mean, we were actually looking for evidence that this wasn't the bus. We were looking for something that would jump out of us and say, there's something wrong here. We never found that. And we became convinced that this was the bus, and we were fortunate enough to be able to buy it at auction and beat out the Smithsonian and bring it to Michigan.
Do you typically go through that kind of search of provenance and whatnot on what you buy?
If it's something that is supposed to have a significant history, yeah, you do. Now, the Dodge Quad Cab, I just want a good one that's in good condition. If it happens to have a nice story, that's fine. Actually, it looks like that this one was only owned by two people, and it looked like they actually did use it mostly as a car because the bed's not all beat up. Huh. And so that fits exactly the story that we're trying to tell. So it kind of depends upon what the claims are about this thing. But you do, if there's supposedly some special story, you want to be able to verify that story.
So of all the different vehicles that you have there, whether it's bikes or planes or the cars, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I do. There's a vehicle that is a 1906 Locomobile race car. It won the Vanderbilt Cup, which was at that point was the great American auto race. It was held over the open roads of Long Island. It won the Vanderbilt Cup in 1908. And the number on the car, the race number, is 16. And it came down to history as Old 16.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's really cool.
I read about that car when I was in junior high. And I got to see it a number of years ago when the fellow who owned it then, Jerry Helk, brought it out to the long-defunct Meadowbrook Historic Races. And ultimately, his family put it up for sale because it was so valuable. By then, taxes were going to be a problem, and we were able to acquire it. And it's a car whose provenance can be traced all the way back to the factory when we know every single owner. And so that one... I love them all, but I have a special affinity for that one.
So when you sneak out one night and you steal the car keys, that's the one you're going to steal it to, right?
Well, you got to crank it, so it's okay. And it's a 16-liter engine. So
wow!
You don't crank it easily.
And is there a car that you wish? Dang, I wish we got that one. Is there the big one that got away?
There's actually not. Interestingly, this Lakester, this belly tank car, had come up for auction. We bid on it. A private owner paid, I think, foolish money for it, far more than we could pay. Then came the stock market crash et al., and suddenly this vast collection of cars of his was available at no reserve at an auction house again. And this time the price was far more reasonable and we were able to get it. So there was a case where we lost one and got it back.
So for anybody who doesn't know, the museum was started by Henry Ford, who recognized things are, and this is going back, you know, quite a ways, more than half a century, right? And
Henry Ford actually started collecting old things, farm equipment, clocks, dishes, just automobiles, wagons, old stuff, stuff that was disappearing in the 20s. I mean, what was happening is the automobile for which he was in which he played a great role. The automobile was changing America forever, and the world he grew up in was going away. And so he started collecting the evidence of that. And eventually he collected so much of it that he had to do something with it. And he built this museum and village. And we officially
collected buildings, as a matter of fact, in the village, which is so awesome.
Edison's workshop.
The Wright Brothers workshop.
Bicycle shop. I mean, it's just unbelievable when you really see this stuff.
And we opened in 1929. And so we've been around as a museum ever since. And the important thing is, I mean, I love to talk about the cars, obviously, but we are a museum of American history, and we collect things that are representative, and so we're continuing to collect today. I mean, iPhones and all of these sorts of things that are clearly the kinds of things that Henry Ford would have collected in his day.
But you got a couple of things that went beyond being an American. You had one of my favorite race cars of all time. I think it was about a 1955 Mercedes 300 SLR that Fangio had driven. But I don't think you got that anymore, right?
Well, actually, Fangio probably drove it, but not in competition.
Hmm.
That was one of my favorite cars. I love those cars. That car, as we examined it, what we found was that car was the test mule, and it never ran in competition, but it probably means every Mercedes driver drove it.
Yeah.
And it was it had come over here on a tour after they'd won the World Championship in 1955, the World Sports Car Championship it was then. And it was on display here, and Mercedes offered to give it to us. We ultimately worked an arrangement and gave it back to Mercedes, sent it back to Mercedes. And on one hand, it broke my heart because I love that car. On the other hand, it never ran in the U.S. It literally had no U.S. history other than being on tour here. And we just felt that it was...
Not appropriate for the collection.
Yeah, yeah. I will tell you, the night before it left, I went out and sat in it because I knew I was never going to get a chance to do that again. So we do make these decisions where things, if I were a private collector, God, I'd never let it go. But we have to think about things in a different way.
And then the other one that I was going to bring up that I don't think falls under your purview, but the museum has got, I think, several gigantic Watt steam engines that were used in mines to pump water out.
Yes.
But I believe they're like the first steam engines ever made in history that were brought over piece by piece from England.
We have the oldest surviving steam engine in the world. Henry Ford loved steam engines. And he literally had agents scour the country, and they found these things. And they're massive. And originally they were pumping water out of mines. That's all they did. He brought them over, and they are embedded in the foundation of the museum. But we have, I would say, certainly the finest collection of those steam engines in the country and maybe the world. The Science Museum in London might rival that. But, they're wonderful.
So I guess, even though it has no connection to America's, as long as Henry Ford wanted it, that's okay.
Well, and with something like the steam engines, that's the beginnings of the British Industrial Revolution, and it's also the roots of the American Industrial Revolution. So with our cars, for instance, we've got some very early Benzes. We've got an 1894 Benz. Benz Velo, which was an example of the world's first production car. Well, that's very important. And so we're not limited to just American things, but they have to be. They have to have a larger historical significance whose impact you can trace to the United States.
This is really good stuff. We got to take a quick commercial break, and then we got to get to rapid fire because I'm sure the audience would love to ask you.
I do want to talk about our new exhibit.
Oh well, one sec. Let's take a quick break here because we want to thank Bridgestone for being a great sponsor of this show. They've been with us since the beginning. Check it out at BridgestoneTire.com, especially if you're in the business, not just as a consumer. If you're running a product line and you're looking for tires for your product, they've got their run-flat tires. They've got what they call eco-focused, low-rolling-resistant tires, winter tires, performance tires, touring tires, you name it. They've got quite a lineup at Bridgestone. You can check it all out at BridgestoneTire.com. Okay, back to Bob now. And, yeah, talk about your new exhibit then, what you're doing there.
We have, since 1987, we've had a wonderful automobile exhibit called The Automobile in American Life. And that's it. This is when we brought in not only cars, but a gas station.
McDonald's.
And a diner, McDonald's sign. That exhibit is getting long in the tooth. And a lot of things have happened since 1987. We are redoing that exhibit with a new title. The new title will be Driving America. And if you come to the museum now, you won't see an automobile exhibit. The floor has been cleared where that exhibit was. We still have cars on the floor, but they're just lined up in a row. We're redoing the exhibit. The exhibit is set to open, fully open probably in January of 2012. But we're trying a very different approach. We're leaving things. The gas station's not going away. The neon signs, the diner, that's all staying. But we're trying intellectually a different approach. Most car exhibits, and ours was no exception, are really done from the standpoint of the industry and the technology. And what was the industry trying to do? How were they trying to sell cars? What was the technology? We've tried to turn it around and say, let's look at the car from the standpoint of the people who used it. So, for instance, this is where we get into why didn't anybody clamor to buy Sylvester Roper's car in 1865? Why did they want to buy cars in 1895? Something happened. How did the car move from being, at the turn of the century, all automobiles were called, unless they really were like trucks or the few motor buses that are around, they were called pleasure cars because they were really toys. Somewhere in the 1920s, the word pleasure car dies and they all become passenger cars. That signals a big change in people's attitude. They're no longer just for recreation.
They're a necessity.
They're a necessity. They're part of our lives. So we're trying to look at every car from the standpoint of the user. What does it say? Why would someone want to buy this car? Or what does it say about someone who buys it? We're looking at the question of safety. Again, there's been a huge change in attitude. For years, 25, 35, 40,000 deaths in cars was kind of accepted as routine. Somewhere in the 60s, that attitude began to change. And you know, Ralph Nader gets the credit, that's only, or the blame, depending on your point of view. That's only part of it. But the public's attitude changed. And that has real consequences. Hardly anybody gets in a car now without putting a seatbelt on. Yet there was a time when the government tried to have that seatbelt interlock. My God, you think the Tea Party got excited. Jeez, there was a revolt over that.
There was. In fact, it's the only safety regulation, maybe the only automotive. No, it is the only automotive regulation that Congress stepped in and said,
yep.
Pull it off the books.
But most of us, and I think wisely, get in a car today, and the first thing we do is buckle a seatbelt. I would much prefer that we do it because we think it's a good thing than because we're told to do it. But think of the change that's taken place if you're a child. We all grew up riding in cars in the front seat, talking to our parents, sleeping in the back seat, hanging over the
shelf.
A car was a wonderful place to be. If you're a kid today, you're stuck in the back seat, lashed in, and it's a very different experience.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, I never thought of that.
So we're trying to look at the car from all these different ways. We've got a number of cars with different power sources. We've got steamers. We've got electrics. Both we got an electric from 1896, and we got an EV1. We've got a 2002 Toyota Prius. We have a gasoline hybrid from 1916.
Oh my gosh.
We've got a Chrysler Turbine car. And so in one area, we examine this whole business of power sources and why. Why aren't we all driving steam cars? And what happened to electric cars anyway? Because they were all over the place before about 1915. There's another area where we look at road trips and vacations and family cars and how they've changed over time. But we're always trying to look from the standpoint of the people who are using or buying cars. So it'll be a very different take. We're bringing out some wonderful vehicles that have been in storage for years, especially some of our older big brass cars. And we are adding some of these surprising cars that we talked about, and I really think it's going to be a dynamite exhibit.
When will it be open?
It's scheduled to open in January. If you want to follow, however, the progress, you can go to blog.thehenryford.org. And there is, along the right side of that page, a whole bunch of topics. And if you click on transportation exhibit, you can follow it. Right now, if you go on there, there are pictures of the floor that's been cleared and the big empty spaces. But we'll be updating that blog as time goes on. You'll be able to follow the progress of the exhibit.
That's cool. That's great. Now let's get to rapid fire. Ben, let's start it going. Okay, George from Brooklyn says, what modern production car would you preserve for a museum display 50 years from now and deduct 10 points if you say Volt?
Lord. Frankly, this is one of the reasons that we shy away from getting the newest cars, because I don't know which one is going to be.
They have to
worthwhile.
Prove themselves.
They have to demonstrate that there's of some historical value, and in a few years we'll know whether the Volt is important or whether it's just a footnote.
Unsprung wants to know: do you have one of every model car that Ford ever built?
We do not. We would not have enough room to ever do that.
Are there any cars in the museum that you've decided you really don't want anymore? Sounds like this is from Mark D. White. It sounds like he might want to buy one.
No, not at this point, no.
Okay. One sec here. Could you talk a moment about Eisenhower's... Oh, this is a very interesting one. Steve wants to know, could you talk a moment about Eisenhower's cross-country trip in the second decade of the last century, said to be very important in the development and tanks, and perhaps a few remarks about U.S. Auto Company's World War II? It's getting into a whole bunch of things. Do you know about Eisenhower's cross-country trip?
When Eisenhower was, God, I think he was, whether he was a captain or a major, he was put in charge of a cross-country motor truck trip, military trucks to demonstrate or at least test the feasibility of cross-country transportation. And it was a nightmare. The roads were awful, and these trucks took forever to get across the country.
And that's part of the reason we have our interstate transportation system today.
Exactly.
Which came about in the Eisenhower administration.
It was a lesson that he remembered. And, of course, when he got to Germany during World War II, they had Autobahn.
Yeah.
And he saw these fabulous roads. And when he got the opportunity as president to push it and sign it, he signed the Interstate Highway Bill.
But they did prove that you could take trucks across.
Not very easily.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, that's part of Eisenhower's claim to fame is he was a master at logistics. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that shows where his roots came from. Joseph N. says, engines don't last forever unstarted. Plus, it's just a waste of the auto workers' artisanship. How often do these cars get started up?
Not very often. We do not have the staff to keep them running. What we do try to do, however, is at least turn those engines over periodically by hand.
Let us know when you're going to fire up George Montgomery's Willys, because we should go down there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like to do a pass down down Rotunda or something.
Flathead wants to know, any plans to acquire the 34 Ford V8 Bonnie and Clyde were killed in?
No.
Why not?
It may be actually hard. I know that car is supposed to exist. That's one of those things where the provenance gets very difficult to trace.
Okay.
And its historical significance is not worth what it would take to acquire it if the car is real.
Gotcha. Hey, Ben, I see we got some phoners coming in. Let's bring in one of those.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I was reading on the internet, is it true that Lieutenant Dan is trying to push the next generation Corvette, the C8, so I guess not the next generation, the generation after that, onto the Voltec hybrid platform, or making the next generation Corvette an actual hybrid? Hopefully that was just an April Fool's joke, because that would be a disaster.
That's not true. But the C8 will be a seismic shift for the Corvette.
There we go.
The C7 that's coming will have a shorter lifespan, because GM knows they can't do a Corvette for 8 years.
Right.
So the C7 will probably be a 4-year car, and then we'll see the C8 after. And the C8 I expect to be radically different.
There you go. Okay, Jacob Dust wants to know, Bob, if there is one car not in your possession that you really want, what would it be?
There's too many. There's too many.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hi there. This is John Dunlap. I'm from down in the Ozarks in Missouri. I just want to call and tell you all something. I watch your show every time it's on. Back there, all three of the shows. But I want you to know what a fine, fine show John and his puts on. And you always have such wonderful people to interview. Thanks for everything. Bye.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate that.
We do appreciate that.
And that goes for you too, Bob.
Thank you. I'm glad, proud to be here.
Bob, Ben, you got another phone coming in?
Hey, John, this is Rick in San Diego. Hey, what do you guys think of the Nissan sales with the Sentra and, the Versa's always done well. What do you think that's due to, the Leaf or maybe the Versa itself or just better deals? I do agree with Peter. I think the Focus and the Cruze and the Elantra and the Civic and the Corolla will become that segment will become the new mainstream family car. Of course, they've gotten a little bit bigger. They're almost the size of the original Camry. But anyway, comments?
Why Nissan's doing so well?
Well, the Nissan Altima was the best-selling car in America last month.
They do have deals on them. but I have no idea why. No, it's one of the mysteries of automotive life right now. It's not the advertising.
Right. Yeah, no, it was real surprising, and I'm sure Nissan's, you know, just thrilled that the Altima was the best.
I actually think it's a tribute to their dealers.
Mm, really? Yeah. The dealers, huh? Oh, very interesting. Okay, back to you, Bob. Sean wants to know, do you have any World Rally Championship Ford Rally cars?
We do not. Once we finish this car exhibit, we're actually working on an exhibit that will be called Racing in America. Of course, World Rally cars, the World Rally is not real big in America. And so if it were to become big, a World Rally car might be appropriate. But our focus will really be racing in America. And so that somewhat limits the
scope. We were at the kickoff for the Racing in America exhibit last summer at the Henry Ford.
In fact, we did the show right there, right? That was an awesome show. We got some very famous race people on.
Yeah, that was a great show.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, have you ever worked with Jay Leno and his car collection?
Jay has visited our car collection. We've been able to, I've been lucky enough to go out and see his car collection. I can't say we've actually worked together, but he has come out and seen our collection.
Ben, have we burned up all the phoners?
I think so.
Okay, let me see if I got some more. Glenn E. says, I like seeing Ike. Had to put one of my dogs down on Tuesday. Ooh, that hurts, man. That's the problem with dogs. They die on you, and the only solution is go get another one. Let's see. Here's somebody who's a little bit skeptical on what we were saying before. He says, a four-cylinder F-150? Can you say dog? Actually, we weren't talking about four-cylinder F-150. No, we said Explorer. Yeah, and people are going to be amazed. That turbo with the direct injection, the way they've got it calibrated with the transmission, you're not going to believe it. And let's see. I think we're really about at the end here of the questions. So
it's been great to have you.
Oh, Bob, this has been a delight to be here.
Really good.
Oh, man.
I appreciate being invited.
You know, and people always, you know, come into Michigan or should I go see the Henry Ford? Yes.
Yes.
You should go.
Yes.
And the village.
It's really an incredible experience.
And the village opens April 15th.
There you go.
And the museum is open year-round.
And the museum had me in. What'd you say? That was 2005?
2005.
And I don't know why they asked me, but they had me come in, and it was a bunch of other historians, too, from around the country to say, what should we be doing with the museum? And everybody had all these ideas, or you have to change this and you have to change that. And my advice was, yeah, these are great ideas and you should incorporate them, but don't forget this is a phenomenal museum, maybe the best in the world that I have personally ever been to. So don't just throw everything away because you want to have a change. Don't lose the essence of what this place is about.
Exactly. And we didn't even talk about the planes.
Oh, I know.
I mean, the planes are just awesome.
We have a great aircraft collection, yes.
Now, do you have the original Wright Brothers plane or does the Smithsonian?
The Smithsonian has the original Wright Brothers plane. We've got the original Sikorsky helicopter.
I'd like to be the test pilot for that.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
You're going to go up, Clyde? Yeah. I guess.
It was
just
Igor Sikorsky.
Back on that stick.
And see what happens.
See what happens. It's supposed to go up. Okay.
Wow. No, the test pilot was Igor Sikorsky. Yeah, he was the designer. So he was going to test it out.
I'm going to go fly that thing now. Oh, good. How much do we have in our bank account?
That's right.
Just let me know.
Well, Bob Casey, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. This has been just terrific having you here. We'll have you back, too. Once you get the new exhibit open.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to come back.
We'll come down there and go through it all and have you back on the show.
You can broadcast from the exhibit.
Hey, we might take you up on that. That would be pretty cool.
And we won't be here next week, John.
Oh, yeah.
Two weeks from tonight.
Two weeks from tonight.
We are taking a break next week.
Peter, you're going to Long Beach.
Yeah, for the Grand Prix.
I'm going to Taiwan. I'm going to figure out what the heck is going on there automotive industry-wise. So, yeah, we'll be off next week. And, Peter, great seeing you, though.
It's great seeing you, John. And let's not forget.
Yeah, that's why I brought the book out.
Right. It's a beautiful thing.
Peter's got his book out, Witch Hunt. Let me read it. Essays on the U.S. auto industry and the blithering idiots who almost killed it. So it just came in the mail. I haven't even had a chance to crack it open. But this is going to be my plane ride read on the way to Taiwan.
You better bring some backup.
All right. So good seeing you, Peter. We'll see you in two weeks.
Yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks, folks.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.